history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are without question stories there that are worth hearing. And we're never going to get to hear them unless we take a little time to ask some questions and then listen to the eye-opening responses that come back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we journey down that path, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Here on Hometown Heroes, every weekend is Veterans Day weekend, but we have arrived at that weekend in which our entire nation pauses to honor those who have served. And it's a pretty special anniversary here in 2018. It was 100 years ago in 1918 that the war to end all wars, World War I, officially came to an end during the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. Armistice Day would become first an unofficial holiday, then a legal holiday. Congress designated November 11th that way in 1926, and what began as a day to honor those who'd served in World War I would eventually expand to include all veterans from all wars. In 1954, Armistice Day was redesignated as Veterans Day. And instead of our normal pattern of hearing from one World War II veteran from start to finish today, I thought this Veterans Day weekend would be a good occasion to celebrate all veterans through a little mosaic, if you will, a taste of multiple veteran stories that, when taken together, underscore a reality that was evident 7 decades ago and certainly relevant today. We are a very diverse nation. Those 16 million Americans who put on a uniform in World War II represent every imaginable background from a geographic, economic, ethnic, religious, or ideological standpoint. But when confronted with enemies that threatened our country and the future of the free world, they got past all their differences and became truly united behind their common cause. I trust that you'll take time out to thank the veterans in your life this weekend. And as we listen to a few of their stories today, know that each one of these Americans whose voices you'll hear represent thousands, even millions more, who endured the same kind of circumstances so you and I could enjoy the freedom we so easily take for granted. There are so many stories that come to mind on Veterans Day, and we can't hear all of them, but you're going to hear from 3 different vets today. One Army, one Navy, one Marine Corps. They all shared their stories on Hometown Heroes within this past year. And we'll start with a recipient of the Silver Star and the Purple Heart, who I had the privilege of meeting in Las Vegas, Nevada. Bob Andre lied about his age and joined the Marine Corps at 16. He was just 17 when he survived the bloody Battle of Tarawa, and just 18 when his injuries ended the war for him on Saipan.
I was on guard duty that night from midnight until time to get up, 6 o'clock or something like that. And I'm sitting on my feet in a foxhole, my back against a tree, with my pistol laying on my lap. I had a 45 at that time. My pistol was laying on my lap. Nothing was going on. All of a sudden, I'd look, all these guys are coming at me. And I couldn't see them, so I knelt down. I'm looking, and they were close enough. I could see they were Japs. So I started hollering, they were Japs, Japs. And I start firing. Well, I only had 8 shots. I always put one in the chamber, then I put the clip in, which is 7. And so first thing I start doing is start shooting at them, because they were closer than she is. And just shooting at them, you know, all around. And I ran out of ammo. And the guy coming at me, he was with a bayonet rifle. He didn't shoot, so I figured after that he was out of ammunition too. So I jumped up when he was coming at me with that bayonet. I just threw my pistol at him, and it hit him someplace. Then I jumped up and grabbed the rifle. So we wrestled. Now, one of the guys in the foxhole put his carbine up underneath the Japs' area here, and just unloaded the rifle, the carbine. And the others, what was left, retreated. But we were on the top of a hill like that. And when I was fighting with that guy, he was on right on the crest. They start going down. Well, then all the ones that were left, couldn't see him. So I got back down the foxhole. And I didn't have my machine gun at the time. I'd lost it in a fight earlier. Anyway, I walked over to their 2 first lieutenants. One was an acting captain, the other was his executive officer. And I told him, if I had my machine gun, I could have got most of them. Now I'm 18 years old. I think I know what I'm doing. And anyway, just then, I heard a guy hollering, help, help, help. So I just jumped up, and I didn't know why, but I ran out there to help him. The one of them, guy was holding this guy that fell back in his arm when he got shot. He was already dead, and the other guy was standing holding him. Well, I ran around to pick up his feet, and he got shot, and he went down, so I went down too. And I crawled around to him to see if I could help him. As I said, the other guy was dead. So I just started dragging him, and I didn't get shot. I got a hand grenade in my leg, shrapnel in my leg. That ended me. That was the end of my war experience right there.
So I'm guessing that I know you're a recipient of the Purple Heart and the Silver Star.
Yeah.
Those both come in that one action right there that you're talking about?
Yeah. I got the hand grenade.
Yeah.
So that was the Purple Heart.
And you were risking your own life to try to save another, thus the Silver Star.
That's what it amounts to.
Yeah. Let's fill in some blanks, though. Right before that, you're saying, if I had had my machine gun, I could have taken them out. So that situation where you're on guard duty and your pistol's on your lap and you see all these Japanese running towards you in the dark.
Yeah.
How badly were you guys outnumbered there?
Well, at that particular time, I have no idea, but all I know, there was a lot of them coming.
And you unload every round that you have.
I only had eight. I did have time to reload.
And then it's hand-to-hand combat. I mean, it's you or him.
Yeah, that's what happened there, yeah.
Had you ever, I'm sure you trained for that a little bit, but...
No. Oh, yeah, we had bayonet training and all that kind of stuff.
Does your adrenaline start pumping a little bit?
That's why I think I went out there. I was already, I had that going and I didn't know it. After thinking about it often, why did I do such a stupid thing? Because I could see the Japs out there, all of them shooting at us. Mm-hmm. And I ran right into it. We were told not to do that.
But it sounds like you didn't hesitate.
Well, evidently not, no.
And you weren't scared during any of this?
I don't remember being scared. I was too busy doing something.
So you go to help this guy. The other guy that he was trying to help is dead.
Yeah.
Then he's wounded. And as you're trying to drag him away, what happened? You hear a noise? You feel something? What stopped you?
Well, I felt that piece of metal go into my leg, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I looked down, your body has a lot of pressure, blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And it was shooting like crazy. I mean, up high out of the leg, you know.
So you feel something hit your leg, you look down, and blood is squirting out of there like being shot from a gun.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you starting to get scared yet then?
No. I don't remember ever getting scared.
Wow.
Ever. That doesn't mean that I was brave or anything like that. It was just, I think I was out of my mind, to tell you the truth.
The adrenaline and the intensity of the situation had taken over?
Yeah. And if I had my machine gun, and you're talking about on guard duty, my machine gun would have been in the foxhole where these other two guys were, because we have three in there.
Did I ask you how you lost it?
It was during another fight. Bullet took it out.
So it wasn't functional anymore?
No.
It wasn't like you misplaced it. They knocked it out.
I didn't misplace it, no. I couldn't use it, so they just kept it back in where we were R&R, supposedly. Suppose 1 hour or one night.
So the hand grenade hits, goes into your leg, you're squirting blood everywhere.
I dragged that guy back to a foxhole, first one I ran into, put him in there, and the corpsman came over to start taking care of him because they could see me, but they couldn't see him. They were still shooting at me. So I crawled looking for another hole going over that road, over the hill, trying to get away from their sight.
I had to be losing a lot of blood.
Well, yeah, but the corpsman came back to me, and he used my medical pack, put it on there, and then wrapped it around the leg to stop the bleeding, but it didn't stop it because pressure was so high that the blood was washing away the medicine that he put on there, and it went right through the padding he put on there. It went right through it and still squirting up. Yeah.
And you were still conscious?
Yeah, I was conscious all the time.
Were you in pain?
If I was, I didn't know it. I really don't remember any pain.
So what did they finally have to do to stop the bleeding and save your life?
Well, put a new Band-Aid on until it finally stopped, yeah. All I know is that I was out of the war. The Jeep came up there, and they loaded me on a Jeep and a couple other wounded guys. They triaged me there, and they said, send them out to the hospital ship. They couldn't operate on me there. So they sent me out to the hospital ship, and I stayed there about 3 or 4 or 5 days, I guess, before they finally got around to operating on me.
And what did they have to do to fix you up?
Oh, it cut a big hole in my leg. It was about this big.
So you're about, what, right 6 inches in diameter?
Yeah, big. It went down like a V, and the metal had hit the bone, the main bone. That's where he found it. And so when I was in New Caledonia at the hospital, they'd come in every day and change the bandage and put Vaseline gauze in there. They'd go down to the bone and they'd start wrapping it around because all the skin from here down to the bone was chewed up by that shrapnel.
Wow. So this took a lot of your flesh, but did not damage your bone structure.
No, it didn't hurt. Had it done it, would have been in a damn cast up to the whole body, you know.
Was there some pain at some point?
If there was, I don't remember. I really mean it. I didn't dwell on it anyway. Kind of like now. As far as the Silver Star, I met another one of the guys that was in my outfit, and he had told me that they put me in for the Silver Star, but they put a lot of people in for medals. In Washington, they're the ones who decide. In the Marine Corps, officers don't decide. And it has to be verified by an officer. It happened to be, there were two officers I was talking to when I went out there. And he told me about it. I forgot all about it. After a while, many months, I was finally discharged from the Marines, went home. I was home maybe 8 months or so. Then I got a call that they're awarding me the Silver Star, and they want to put a parade on in Treasure Island, San Francisco Bay, and award me the Silver Star. I sent them a letter back and told them, just send me the star. I can't take time off from work. So I got it through the mail. I didn't get the parade.
Sounds like you weren't looking for the attention.
I guess so. I've told you more than I should, I guess. Just don't feel like, again, showing off or something. Because I know it's quite an honor to get that award, because I know I can pull it up on our iPhones. Uh-huh. You've done that yet?
Your citation?
Yeah.
Maybe I should, so I can read it for our listeners.
Well, you could read that, yeah.
I want to see this right now. I want to watch a 92-year-old Marine Corps Silver Star recipient pull up the citation on his smartphone.
Robert Warren Andre.
Well, there you go. The President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Silver Star to Private First Class Robert W. Andre, United States Marine Corps Reserve, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity while serving with Company C, 1st Battalion, 6th Marines, 2nd Marine Division, in action against enemy Japanese forces on Saipan, Marianas Islands, 8 July 1944. When his platoon was momentarily held up during a firefight, Private First Class Andre observed a wounded man in front of the lines. Despite accurate enemy fire, he went to the aid of his comrade, and, although wounded himself, succeeded in returning the wounded man to our lines. His courage and devotion to duty were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. They thought that was a big deal, Bob.
Yeah, I guess they did. I'm glad to get back in one piece.
Is it different to hear those words about you, or have you seen them so many times it doesn't faze you?
Well, I think you described it there. I read it, but I can't believe I did that.
Yeah, that's. I guess when you think back on it now, I know you were just 18, but do you think you would do that again if given the chance?
No, being realistic, I don't think so.
You think that guy was kind of foolish or risking his life too much?
The guy that did that?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, but I'm glad I did it.
And I'm sure the guy whose life you saved was glad you did it.
I hope so, yeah.
You ever wonder what happened to him?
I have occasionally, but not lately. I figure if he's not passed on, he's pretty close to it.
Did you ever find out his name?
No, I really didn't.
But if that wounded Marine is out there listening somewhere, he now knows the name of the man who saved him. That is Bob Andre of Las Vegas, Nevada, who says he put some of his Marine Corps training into use in a law enforcement career that followed his World War II service. You can link to his original interview at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And when we come back, a small town in Colorado would not be the same without the Navy veteran you're going to have the chance to meet. This special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Veterans Day edition featuring three different vets from three different states, three different branches of service, but a common commitment to the ideals of America. Julesburg is a small town in the northeastern corner of Colorado. About 1,300 people live there, but a lot of people come through there. And earlier this year, when a blizzard whited out western Nebraska and northeast Colorado, quite a few travelers found themselves stranded in Sedgwick County because Interstate 80 and all the roads in and out were closed. In Lee Kaiser's old Ford garage and museum in Julesburg, they found not only physical warmth, but plenty of emotional warmth and a whole lot of history. Lee was Julesburg's barber for nearly 70 years. He's also been the mayor. His old Ford garage and museum preserve not only classic cars, but local history and military history as well. Check out the videos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a taste of that. And listen as Lee shares what he remembers of that small town of Julesburg on December 7th, 1941.
We had a little ball game going on in the vacant lot right west of where our house was. All of a sudden, somebody come running out and says, "We've been bombed, we've been bombed." And somebody said, "Well, where?" And they said, "Well, Pearl Harbor." And of course they said, "Well, where in the world is Pearl Harbor?"
And I guess you probably found out pretty quickly. And did you see things changing right after that?
Immediately. The lady next door to us had a boy in the Navy. He graduated out of high school in 36 up here. Nothing to do during the Depression, so he joined the Navy. A month before Pearl Harbor, he was on the USS Arizona. A month before Pearl Harbor, he was transferred to the cruiser USS Houston. Well, we know what happened to the Arizona. He missed that. He went down in the South China Sea. A shore battery hit the ship, and three sailors was killed, and he was one of them. Then 1 month later, the cruiser Houston went down into around Guadalcanal, and they got in between two battleships, and they blew her all to pieces. And there was very few survivors on it. What few survivors were sent to build the bridge of River Kwai. And to finish the story, we were playing ball again 2 weeks later, and when the mother got the telegram from the depot that her son, Glenn Wise, was killed on the Houston.
So even in a small town in the corner of Colorado, the war brought death to this small town.
Yes, it did.
Tell me how you ended up in the Navy.
Well, when you take your examination at the New Custom Building in Denver, they give you your examination, and then they line you up. I don't know how they did anywhere else, but in that particular day, as we walked through that line, they said, Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, Army, Navy, Marines. And I just happened to land up in the Navy.
Boy, that's kind of crazy to think about, isn't it? That just that random pattern could determine someone's fate.
That's right. And all the kids in that area that got the Marines were all on Iwo Jima. And but I was in the Navy, and I was at Iwo Jima too, but aboard ship.
So you're saying if you were one spot off in line, you would have been wearing a Marine Corps uniform and getting shot at on those beaches.
That's right. However, when we got left boot camp, we all caught three destroyers in Bremerton, the Hull, the Spence, and the Monahan, and the Wilson. During the Lady Gulf invasion, a month before that, Admiral Halsey was caught in the worst typhoon that ever hit the Pacific. We were supposed to be on the Hull, but the Hull and Spence and Monaghan all capsized during that typhoon. The reason why they did is because they pumped their ballast off to take on fuel, and we were next to take on fuel. But we still had our balance. We were still sitting low in the water.
Yeah, I've interviewed survivors from the Hull and the Monaghan who survived that typhoon. Oh. Yeah, miraculously. So.
Well, they would be my boot camp buddies because that boot camp, out of that 150 in that boot camp, there's only five guys got schooling. All the rest of us went right aboard ships.
So I understand. What was the point at which you would have gone on one of those ships, and why did you go to the Wilson instead?
Because the guy before me was a Marine, so he went to the Marines, and then I went to the Navy, and then so forth. It was just a matter of luck what ship we went on.
And what was your job aboard this destroyer, the Wilson?
I was a signalman, a striker. We didn't get school, so we'd pick out a group aboard ship that you thought that you'd like to be in. And I saw the signalman up there up on the bridge all the time and looked like they were doing a really fantastic job of talking to everybody from other ships. And I thought, I asked if I could join their gang, and they did. They let me in. April 16th at 9:30 in the morning, we were sitting off of Okinawa a ways, waiting for, we called the cap, waiting for the suicide planes to come in. And then to the south of us, here come a low-flying plane, and our captain said he's heading for us. And as he approached, he said he's going to get us. And he did. He hit us. He was carrying a 500-pound bomb. He released the bomb before he got to the ship. The bomb went through the skin of the ship but did not explode. But the rest of the plane went over the fantail of the ship and scraped it with all the guys on the back of the ship.
And you're telling me what the captain's saying, and I want to make sure I understand. You're with him there on the bridge, and you're hearing him saying it, like from me to you?
Yes, real close.
And could you see it too?
Oh, yes, I saw it coming in. But I had the phones on, my helmet on, and the phones was connected to the cord. The whole ship was communicated with each other anytime. And so the captain said, "We got to get out of here." So I was the first one around the corner of the bridge. I come to the end of the cord, fell on my back, and the rest of the crew fell on, the captain fell on top of me, and pushed in the speaker in my mouth and on my nose. I lost all my teeth of it. But they didn't fall out, and they said, "Anybody hurt?" And I was just a young 18-year-old kid, and I didn't report it. No, I'm all right. But later on, the Navy put in some teeth for me.
So how many teeth did it knock out?
All my bottom teeth and several of my upper teeth. Some of them didn't fall out until after I got home.
Did break your nose too?
Yeah.
And this was all trying to get out of there and try to help wherever help's needed. But what were you able to do after sustaining that injury?
Well, there's always a little bit of humor, whatever it happens. And I was laying on my back looking up, and the captain was on his stomach looking down right face to face. And he says, "Sailor, get to your post right now or I'll court-martial you." And I said, "Captain, just as soon as you get off the top of me, I will."
And it's good to have humor. You need it in those situations, but I'm sure it wasn't long till you realized some of your shipmates had been killed.
Right. We found that out later. Now, here was an event that was kind of sad. The men in the magazine were trapped, and the chief come up to the captain and says, "The magazine's smoking, Captain, and we don't know whether it's on fire, but if it's on fire and in the magazine, she's going to blow." And Captain says, "Well, what do you recommend, flood the magazine or take a chance he won't blow?" Chief said, "I'm not making that decision. You'll have to make it." So the captain said, "Then flood the magazine," meaning that if they weren't dead, that they drowned. And he said, "Now don't ever tell me how they died." He was a captain from the Great Lakes area out of Chicago, and he was a very good captain.
Can you imagine having that decision rest on your shoulders, having to make that life or death call about those sailors?
I thought about that my whole life and still do. But I imagine a lot of commanders in World War II had to make similar type of decisions.
And I think I read there were five men who died that day?
Right.
Were they all in the magazine?
Yeah, and that's where I was supposed to be, because everybody changes places ever so often to become efficient in case you do get hit. No matter where you are, you're supposed to be well-trained for wherever you are. And those were all my shipmates and buddies that got killed.
And what do you mean you were supposed to be there? Your shift was about to change or what?
Well, no. Some of the guys are on the bridge and some of the guys on general quarters. We change back and forth so that we become sufficient in no matter where we are aboard ship that we can fill in. And it just so happened that I was on the bridge at that time.
And I know this is redundant for you or obvious, but for folks listening, I know they're reading between the lines, but let's spell it out really clearly. Your captain in that moment had to decide whether to definitely sacrifice those five lives or their lone chance of saving those lives was risking the rest of the ship, right? I mean, what would have happened if that magazine blew up?
The ship would have went down, especially with that 500-pound bomb and the magazine, probably in 30 seconds. She would have broke right into and sank. There probably would have been, if any, very few survivors out of the 300 guys aboard ship. Captain Roberts was the captain at that time, and he was a very, very good captain, very considerate to everybody.
And if you had been in that magazine, like you easily could have, you certainly would have wanted him to save your life. But the decision he made likely did save your life, right?
That's right. He saved mine because I wasn't in that magazine.
Well, and if he didn't flood it and it exploded, you would have been out of luck.
Yeah, that's right.
And you mentioned the 500-pound bomb that didn't explode. Where did that bomb end up?
In the communication compartment where all the signalmen and the radiomen were. A demolition squad came aboard from one of the big tenders and disarmed the bomb. Then they gradually pushed it out the same hole that it went through the skin of the ship, which the back end was underwater, and then shoved it out into the ocean. Then the crews come in and they welded the plate where the bomb went through. Then we pumped all the water out of the back end of the ship and went right back into action again.
Well, I asked you about the magazine, if it had exploded. What about that bomb? If that 500-pound bomb had gone off, what would have happened to you?
Well, being on the bridge, it would have buckled and I would have went down with the ship without a question.
You know, it's a lot of history that you've lived through, that you've witnessed and you've been a part of. But I'm just thinking about your personal story. And from the point of, you know, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, you could have been a Marine on Iwo Jima to getting out of boot camp. You could have gone to one of those three destroyers that sank in the typhoon, but you went to the one of the four that didn't, to... You could have been in that magazine that was flooded, those five lives sacrificed to save the rest of the ship, and all these close calls. How do you explain all that? Isn't it kind of hard to believe that all those things went your way?
Well, I think about that quite often, that every time as I got older, the things don't go quite my way, then I get to thinking, geez, Lee, you're one of the luckiest guys in the world.
Well, and I know you believe that. And I know how fortunate this town is to have you, and I can tell just by spending a little time here how revered you are in this place. And here you've built this huge museum, you've preserved so much history. Why do you do it? Why do you keep doing it at age 92? What is so important about this to you?
Well, first of all, I was a good student in history in high school. We had some books in our library, town library, that you had to read. You couldn't check out. You had to read them there. And I did that. And I just gradually got interested in Western history, the building the railroad and so forth. And I've always history was my favorite class. That's the only subject I really got decent grades in. But I feel fortunate and glad that I did. Now, to answer your question, why I put this together was that I used to play golf with my buddies here in town. And we would meet every Sunday morning for golf. And one day I realized that I'm with these guys downtown all day long, and then on Sunday, I'm with them again. So I'm going to do something else besides play golf. And I have two brothers that just are both retired military, and all they want to do is just play golf. And I decided that golf takes too much of your time if you want to do something else in life. And so I put this together.
Well, and I know Julesburg thanks you, and America thanks you, and I thank you for that. And I saw the barber chair. You said 68 years. Did you start cutting hair in the Navy?
No. I went to University of Denver for a year, and my folks still had three little kids at home. And even though I had the GI Bill, I let a friend of mine, he said, well, why don't you go to barber school and work your way for your last 3 years in school? Well, I did, but I never did go back into school.
Well, I think it worked out all right for you. Have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington yet?
Yes, I have. The Honor Flight.
Was that Northern Colorado Honor Flight?
Yes. Yeah, great ship. One of the best things I've ever done is for the people that honored us the way they did. Every place we went, we had a clapping ovation. So appreciative.
What did you think about at that World War II memorial, especially when you look at that wall of gold stars, 406,000 guys like you who didn't come home? What was going through your mind there?
I knew that the figures before, 400,000 dead, 600,000 wounded, but I didn't realize that that gold star would represent that many people. But that really makes you think how lucky you were that you weren't one of them. But, you know, the other thing is, they got to remember that only 1 out of 12 of 16 million men saw action.
And I know you saw plenty. Did you think about those five guys from the magazine when you were at that memorial?
I got their name by my nightstand where I read at, and every once in a while I dig that out, and I got them on a card, and I think about them. The chance that they didn't have and the chance that I had.
Did you know those guys personally?
Yeah, they were my friends.
And again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think what I heard and what you just said is that the way you've lived, the way you have, the reason that you've done so much for this city and for people and for educating future generations of Americans is partly to honor the life those guys never got to have.
Right. I think about them all the time. Then when I see young people, the way they act nowadays, it's hard for me to have any sympathy for them at all, because the boys in the Depression plus World War II was a great sacrifice. Can you see, once in a while I visualize this, a soldier or a Marine laying on the beach, they'd just been hit with a grenade or a shell, and he was holding his stomach in, probably about to lose it, and look up at the stars and said, God, what did I ever do to deserve this?
It's so hard for those of us who have never been in combat to understand what it was like, but I trust you'll agree stories like these help us a little bit. On Veterans Day and every day, they can help shape our perspective. Go to hometownheroesradio.com to find the complete original interview with Lee Kaiser. And if you're ever driving cross-country, work Julesburg and that old Ford Garage and Museum into your itinerary. You will not regret it. When we come back, meet a man who overcame discrimination and a segregated military in World War II to become a pioneering heart surgeon. This special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to this special Veterans Day weekend edition of Hometown Heroes, remembering that when it comes to our veterans, all gave some, and some gave all. The next voice you're going to hear was the subject of a recent mini-documentary you can watch online at hometownheroesradio.com. Dr. Fitzalbert Marius was born in Panama, raised in Harlem during the Great Depression, and was already an accomplished tailor, artist, and musician when he left college during his sophomore year to join the Army Specialized Training Program with the aim of becoming a doctor. At the time, he was mistakenly classified as Caucasian. Once the Army figured out that he wasn't, he was moved into an all-black unit, the 725th Medical Sanitary Company in the Pacific, starting with New Caledonia.
New Caledonia is a French-influenced area, and it was very interesting because the United States of America had an armed depot there, you know, that they collected things and then so on down the line. But they needed, you know, translators. And, of course, they looked at my record, and even though the Army was segregated, you know, I spoke French, so they put me in there to be as an interpreter to the people who in that area who were working there who spoke French. Now, the other interpreter who was there was a white lieutenant from Mississippi. As a matter of fact, he happened to be teaching language, and French was one of the languages he taught in the University of Mississippi. But he grew up in Mississippi. He had, of course, a Mississippian accent. So even when he spoke French, you heard the Mississippi accent in it. Huh. Like, if you want to say, do you want something to eat in French? Say, est-ce que vous voulez quelque chose pour manger maintenant? Okay, you want something to eat right now. Well, he said, in his French southern accent, est-ce que vous voulez chose pour manger maintenant? First time I've ever heard French spoken with a southern accent. And they couldn't understand him. And they would turn to me and say, qu'est-ce qu'il dit? What did he say? But I had to be very careful. I had to whisper to them in French, I'll explain to you later. Because I didn't want to explain nothing in front of him. After, you know, he'd finished and told him all he wanted him to do, then I would go off someplace and they'd follow me. And then I would tell them in French that they could understand. But I knew better to embarrass him. Because
sure.
He was a lieutenant, and I was nothing but a private. So anyway, after that is when we moved to places like Guadalcanal and all that sort of stuff, and there were all kinds of experiences. And since we had medical associated with us, they did not arm us.
And let's explain that for people listening. So you're an all-black unit. Mm-hmm. That is in the Pacific, and you're following along with the 1st Marine Division. You're attached to the 1st Marine Division. But what was your job? What were you guys supposed to come in and do?
All we're supposed to do was to take care of all of these things like disease, insects, and stuff like that. If there were some certain flies and stuff, we would, to get rid of them, we had the stuff to spray, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Dig the ditches, to drain the swamps, you know, and all that sort of stuff. That's what we did. And then of course, when things happened, to bury the dead. Now, what happened, as a matter of fact, it was in Iwo Jima. When we were going in the invasion of Iwo Jima, they had the two units. So one had to go in because there were certain insects and flies and stuff and that carried a certain amount of certain diseases and stuff that they had to go in to take care of. So they flipped a coin to decide which unit would go in. No, it was a straw, the short straw and the long straw.
All right.
So we'd pick the right straw. So they had to go in first with the 1st Marine Division. And there in Iwo Jima, they had caves up there, and the Japanese had the guns and all that stuff on tracks. They pulled them back into the cave. So even though they bombed all the areas and stuff like that before they sent the troops in, they had all the major troops and stuff all back there because there was an airport there that the United States wanted to control and take over. But anyway, when they first sent the 1st Marines in, they also sent the 727th because the 727th lost and they went in. Now, there's 125 people belonging to each one of those groups. Only three of them made it back. All the rest of them got killed. Now, if we had gone in first, we would have only had three left.
Yeah.
So the Lord was looking out after me and that group. So, and a lot of things happened like that. And at Guadalcanal, almost got wiped out at Guadalcanal because there, the Japanese at that time, you know, had their planes, and we didn't have the fast planes to keep up with them at that time. And they hadn't just put them out yet. And so they would come in and they would bomb the heck out of the areas. And we were in foxholes and they bombed us for 2 weeks and stuff like that. And all kinds of people got killed and so on. But I made it through. And as a matter of fact, the Lord blessed the heck out of me because the whole 3 years or so that I was over in that South Pacific, I did not get one disease. As many enough of these mosquitoes as I got bitten with, I never got malaria. I never got any of those other diseases and all those other, People got shot all around me, and I never got one injury. The Lord was looking out for Bert Marius, because I wasn't looking out for myself. Mm-hmm. I never expected to be able to return back to the United States of America. My attitude was, I am most likely going to die over in the South Pacific. So I did everything to keep me alive every day. But I never expected to get back home.
You mentioned Iwo Jima. When you guys draw straws, the other unit goes in and they're decimated. All but three of them are killed. What about you having to deal with the deaths of people you had come to know? How difficult was that?
Well, you got acclimated to that. It's still the same, you know, people you know and losing is no different then than it is now. Except for the fact is, you know, you have a war attitude that everybody is subject to soon death, including you. That's part of your everyday situation. You wake up. The more you protect yourself and the more you do right, the more potential you have of continuing another day.
And you mentioned that your duties at times included burying the dead. What was that like for you? How difficult was that? How challenging was that?
That was extremely challenging because now you are not talking about burying one or two people. You're talking about getting one of them big ditch diggers and digging out a big trench and then shoving in 100, 200, 300, 1,000 people and then covering them over.
Is that American? Is that Japanese? Is that both?
Both. Depending on the situation. Now, with the Japanese, you didn't worry about IDs and stuff like that. But with the Americans, you make sure you got the dog tags off of them so, you know, had the identities. But you burying human beings with a bulldozer ain't fun. But you do develop a way of handling it so that you can survive because you have to have an attitude of survival. The Japanese had a way, you know, on some of those islands we were on, they would have big speakers. On the speakers, they'd have a beautiful Japanese woman, you know, and as a matter of fact, it was one girl who grew up here in America, and she went on back to Japan and worked as one of their propaganda thing, yeah, Tokyo Rose. And they'd be playing these blues and stuff. Then they would play a song like, "You had a woman you thought you could trust, but I just found out she's cheating on us." Then they announced, "Why are you colored ones up here fighting against us Japanese while the white man is back there sleeping with your wife?" But we had to learn to ignore. We learned and enjoyed the music and would dance to the music, but we wouldn't ignore what they were saying because we knew it was propaganda, because we knew darn well if they weakened us, they'd come and shoot our butt the same way that they would shoot the others. We had some problems with our country, but they were the major enemy. And we weren't over there to solve prejudice. We were over there to take care of the enemy that had attacked America. And we understood you could not solve the problem in the United States of America if the Japanese controlled America. So we had to get rid of that enemy first, and that's where we focused. So we didn't have the kind of attitude, well, I'm not going to work hard to do what is right to save America and hold up the American flag because they ain't treating us right. No, we didn't have that kind of attitude, you know. It's like I tell people, say, we grew up understanding life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not like you young people today. Life, liberty, and happiness without pursuit. You just go out just simply because you woke up in the morning, you're entitled to everything I got. You're entitled to produce or have the opportunity to produce, but you're not entitled to the product. But that's how they feel today.
Dr. Marius would take part in the first ever open heart surgery that Fresno, California had ever experienced in 1958, and he continued to practice in Fresno for more than 60 years, performing more than 11,000 cardiac operations before he finally retired at age 91. He remains very active, an author, painter, sculptor, and custom tailor. He also teaches classes at the Fresno School of Mission, which offers training for pastors and missionaries.
4 years ago, I stopped being involved in physiological heart repair, and I'm 100% in spiritual heart repair. Mm-hmm. Now, I could still be doing it right now. I've developed this attitude. If you do 100% of what you're capable of doing, then you don't have any stress or guilt to carry with you. Whatever I needed to do while I was at the hospital, I stayed as long as was necessary to take care of that situation, as much as I could do with everything that I had. I never bothered to tell this to others, you know, because when I was assisting, like some would come up to me and says, okay, Bert, now I want you on this case because we're operating on the administrator of St. Agnes Hospital, and I want the very best for him, the best anesthesiologist. You one of the most experienced, and I want one of the best assistants, and so on down the line. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, I'll be there. But what I said to myself was this: they don't know who they're talking to. Because every time Bert Marius steps up to that table, whoever is on that table is getting Bert Marius' best. It doesn't matter whether it's the President of the United States, the head of the Ku Klux Klan. If I give an oath that I'm going to take care of you, you're going to get 100% of what I got. You say the best, as if the other people are going to get the best. If it's a bum on the street, he's going to get the same thing the president gets.
I guess here's my question on all that. 55 years of doing these kind of heart surgeries and all those patients that you dealt with, the lives that they led after that, the gift of life you're able to give to so many. What are you most proud of when you think back on that medical career? What gives you the most pride or satisfaction?
Well, the most thing that gives me the pride and satisfaction is that I have come to the point that I understand that anything and everything that Bert Marius is able to accomplish, it is because God gave me the ability to do it. All that matters is whether I am doing it according to his will, not according to my own desire. I can't remember the very last time that I had any anxiety about anything. Just like you see me and most people, and they always ask me, says, how come you always got a smile on your face? I said, because I got joy to come from within. I'm not stressed out about nothing. I go to bed every night absolutely peaceful. I don't have any control, and that's why one of my favorite scriptures is the 47th verse of the second chapter of Acts. After 3,000 were saved, it says, and the Lord added to the church daily. Remind old Bert Marius that no matter how much I teach, no matter how many sermons I might preach, how many books and manuals I write, I don't add one soul to the church. The Lord added to the church. Without him, none of this is possible. You know, being a poet and stuff, I pray this way. Thank you, Lord, for reminding me I'm birthed from dirt and would be completely inert if it were not for you. I thank the Lord for using me to further his kingdom in spite of my human deficiencies and inefficiency. That I'm not taking any credit for any of this myself. The only credit I've taken is the fact that I'm willing to submit to his will and be his steward and his messenger.
That is Dr. Fitzalbert Marius, now 96 years young and going oh so strong this Veterans Day weekend. So today you met three men in three different states representing three different branches of our armed forces. Not only did they risk their lives for the rest of us, they went on to make those communities where they chose to live better places for the rest of us to live. What a reminder of what we can so easily take for granted. That's our program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, encouraging you to thank everyone you know who has served our country and reminding you on Veterans Day and every day that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.